Hello and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed and relived. I am Sebastian Michael and this is Sonnet 47. Betwixt mine eye and heart a league is took, and each doth good turns now unto the other. When that mine eye is famished for a look, or heart in love with sighs himself doth smother, with my love's picture then my eye doth feast, and to the painted banquet bids my heart. Another time mine eye is my heart's guest, and in his thoughts of love doth share a part. So either by thy picture or my love, thyself away are present still with me, for thou not farther than my thoughts canst move, and I am still with them and they with thee. Or if they sleep, thy picture in my sight awakes my heart to heart's and eyes' delight. Sonnet 47 again follows on directly from Sonnet 46, developing the argument further and arriving at a conclusion, which is also maybe not altogether surprising, but which validates the premise set out with Sonnet 46, much more than that on its own led us to expect, thus tying Sonnet 46 tightly into this couple as a unit. Before we look at them both together, what does Sonnet 47 actually mean? Betwixt mine eye and heart a league is took. The sonnet continues, as just mentioned, from Sonnet 46, which ended with a Solomonic judgment by the jury of thoughts, allocating the lover's outward appearance to the eye and his inward love to the heart. My eye and my heart have entered an alliance. League here is an alliance, or also a peace treaty, that allows two warring parties to work together. And each doth good turns now unto the other. And now that their dispute is resolved, they both do each other favours and help each other out. When that mine eye is famished for a look, and here are examples of this. When my eye is longing to see you, famished, of course, means starved or extremely hungry, which leads to the metaphor of the feast and painted banquet in just a moment. And it also underlines the impression we have been getting, further confirmed later in the sonnet, that Shakespeare is away from his lover and that, as we were more or less able to establish, this separation is an extended one. Or heart in love with sighs himself doth smother, or when my heart smothers itself with sighs because it is so in love with you. Both heart and I are here again mildly personified in that they are referred to by a personal pronoun but not capitalized in either the quarter edition or in the majority of current ones. With my love's picture then my eye doth feast, and to the painted banquet bids my heart. Then on such occasions my eye feasts on a picture of you and invites my heart to this painted banquet so my heart can share the delight that derives from it. It is interesting to note that Shakespeare here briefly switches from addressing the young man directly, as he did throughout Sonnet 46 and as he will be doing again throughout the rest of this sonnet, to talking about him in the third person. There is no obvious explanation for this, other perhaps than that feasting on a love's picture is once more something of a poetic commonplace, and it also gives Shakespeare an opportunity to make it clear that you, the young man, are indeed my love and the person my heart is in love with, and not some random substitute. My eye, meanwhile, is unusual, as Shakespeare fairly consistently uses the form mine after a vowel sound, and whether this is a mistake here or, as has been suggested, a way of retaining symmetry with my love's picture that precedes it in the same line and my heart that follows it in the next line cannot be said with any certainty, not least because in a moment Shakespeare will use mine eye and my heart right next to each other. Another time, mine eye is my heart's guest, and in his thoughts of love doth share a part. On another occasion, it will be my eye who will be my heart's guest, implied is by a similar welcome or invitation to share in his, my heart's, thoughts of love for you, which are similarly edifying in their own way. John Kerrigan points out that Shakespeare frequently associates the heart with thought rather than, as we would today, mostly with emotion, science since having located thought mostly in the brain. And indeed, Sonnet 46 had thoughts as tenants to the heart, and in a little while, in Sonnet 69, he will be speaking of the thought of heart. So either by thy picture or my love, thyself away are present still with me. And so either by looking at your picture or by my heart's thoughts of love for you, I can keep you close to me even when you are away. Another minor anomaly is the R in thyself away are present still with me, where we would expect art to go with thyself. But this is not entirely uncommon in Shakespeare, when the verb is followed by a consonant. For thou not farther than my thoughts canst move, and I am still with them, and they with thee. Because you cannot move further away from me than my thoughts, but I am always with my thoughts, and my thoughts are always with you. Or if they sleep, thy picture in my sight awakes my heart to heart's and eyes' delight. Or if they, my thoughts, are asleep and for some reason not thinking of you, then simply looking at your picture will awaken the heart again to the delight of both my heart and eye. Which confirms that, as the first line suggested, heart and eye have not merely signed a truce or stopped fighting over you, they now actively share the pleasure that comes from looking at your picture and thinking of you. And so let's hear these two sonnets that belong together, together, back to back. Mine eye and hearts are at a mortal war, how to divide the conquest of thy sight. Mine eye, my heart, thy picture sight would bar, my heart, mine eye, the freedom of that right. My heart doth plead that thou in him dost lie, a closet never pierced with crystal eyes, but the defendant doth that plead in eye, and says in him thy fair appearance lies. To cite this title is empanelled a quest of thought, all tenants to the heart, and by their verdict is determined the clear eye's moiety and the dear heart's part, as thus mine eye's due is thy outward part, and my heart's right thy inward love of heart. Betwixt mine eye and heart a league is took, and each doth good turns now unto the other, when that mine eye is famished for a look, or heart in love with sighs himself doth smother. With my love's picture then my eye doth feast, and to the painted banquet bids my heart. Another time mine eye is my heart's guest, and in his thoughts of love doth share a part. So either by thy picture or my love, thyself away are present still with me, for thou not farther than my thoughts canst move, and I am still with them and they with thee. Or if they sleep, thy picture in my sight awakes my heart to heart's and eye's delight. The war between eye and heart is amicably resolved, following the wise judgment of thoughts, which, as we noted, are by Shakespeare associated not so much with the head as with the heart, and who therefore could be said to favour the heart. Heart and eye now play together, supporting each other and helping each other out when in crisis. The eye, when it feels hungry for a look at the beautiful young man, feasts on his picture, and it does not do so alone. It invites the lonely, lovesick heart to relish the nourishment it receives as well. Similarly, Heart allows I to share its tender thoughts of love when it soothes itself with wistful memories and hopeful longing. The balance in me, the poet, is restored, and I stand a good chance in this way of sustaining myself through our period of separation because, and this is the real insight the sonnet provides, and at the same time its message, if any, to the young man, thanks to this interplay between my eye and heart, you are always with me, no matter where you are, because when my thoughts are with you, then I am with you, since I am by necessity always with my thoughts, and should my thoughts for any reason be asleep, for which read not actively with you, then all it takes for me is to look at your picture, and both my heart and my eye are once again delighted, and my thoughts naturally return to you straight away. It is not groundbreaking poetry, nor does it really entirely stack up to the rational mind. There are, once again, easily detectable flaws in the argumentation, but it would feel churlish, even petty, to now point them out yet again. Shakespeare here, as on previous occasions, is not trying to convince an actual jury or prove a point of scientific interest. He is essentially improvising on well-rehearsed themes in poetry, with the previous couple on the four elements, with this couple on the dispute twixt eye and heart. It makes these two pairs, 44 and 45, and 46 and 47, a curious square in the canon which most likely doesn't ignite any passion because it isn't intended to. If William Shakespeare were a 20th century musician and the sonnets his songs, then these four would probably feature on the fourth album approximately when the artist has produced a fair amount of work with a few notable hits and now finds himself with a bit of time on his hands to experiment with some ideas and concepts that make for listenable material but are clearly not going to chart as singles. Which may provide us with an opportune moment to remind ourselves, just briefly, that we simply don't know how the collection we have today came about and whether any of these sonnets were ever intended to be published. We don't know whether the young man they refer to ever got to read them, and if so, what he made of them. This is not true of the entire series. There are some sonnets which strongly suggest that Shakespeare uses them as a form of communication, and even some that appear to give us clues as to what the young man's response may have been. One such example that springs to mind is Sonnet 26, of which we said it sounds just like the kind of note you write when you have been rebuked. But this group gives us no such indication. Still, it has found itself into the canon, and this in a position where it makes sense, and so we are probably allowed to simply accept that Shakespeare wrote these sonnets either for his own diversion or therapeutic purposes, or as a continuing stream of messages to his lover during this time when they are clearly apart. The steady, nearly soothing calm these two times two sonnets seem to signal is now nearing its end, though. What comes next is a riveting wave form of doubt, anguish, sorrow, followed by overwhelming joy and bliss, yielding into fully restored confidence as a poet just before it all goes haywire again. And so, if you listened to the episode on Sonnet 43 and were wondering when exactly you should be thinking of putting on your safety belt, now is a good time, because this was nothing if not the calm before a fabulous new storm that will prove bracing and both truly invigorating and really rather devastating, too. This episode goes out on the Sunday before the Monday when I open in Edinburgh with my spoken word solo show, some sonnets and a bit of Bach. And if you want to know what that's about, you will find details on sonnetcast.com, together with the sonnets, the transcripts of this podcast, and also now a donate button if you feel the desire and are in a position to support me in this project. for which I am immensely grateful and truly, truly appreciative, because it is, as you know, a labour of love that is unsponsored and unfunded. Wherever in the world you are, and whichever way you found me, I do hope you will join me again here on Sonnetcast as we recite, reveal and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.